Hello, and welcome to the February episode of the R Science Podcast. I'm Stefan Janusz.
And I'm Ben Cunningham. In our first Café Scientifique of the year, Dr. Sinead Collins from the University of Edinburgh led a discussion on ocean acidification and how it affects our oceans. She is particularly interested in researching marine microbes called phytoplankton and how they adapt and evolve in response to the changing acidity. At the event, there was algae chocolate and photosynthesis music, something the audience hadn't bargained for. We chatted to her to hear more and find out why microbes are so cool.
I'm Sinead Collins. I'm a Royal Society Research Fellow at the University of Edinburgh in the Institute of Evolutionary Biology. And I do experimental evolution with microbes. What that means is I have a lab and I watch microbes evolve in real time to figure out how they evolve. And I'm particularly interested in photosynthetic microbes, those are the green ones, and how they respond to ocean acidification. I don't do really applied science. I make the theory that other researchers would then use to get more specific or applied ideas about how oceans work. And you can sort of think of this in the same way as one thinks about 3D printers. A lot of the innovation happening with 3D printers right now is happening by 15-year-olds making artificial limbs, but that's built on the backs of many, many years of polymer chemists slaving away in laboratories. I am the polymer chemist of evolutionary biology. So we make basic theory, and we ask questions like, how is evolution different when you evolve by yourself or if you evolve in a community? How is evolution different if you come from a highly variable environment, a part of ocean where nutrient levels and light levels fluctuate wildly, or if you come from a fairly stable environment where nutrients and light and fish that are trying to eat you are all relatively consistent? So those are the kind of things I do.
So tonight you're here to do the Café Scientifique. What would you like your audience to take away tonight?
Microbes matter. I'd like them to take away that this stuff is really fun, that there's a lot of really amazing things in the world that are not about humans. So a lot of the science that I read and that I love reading and I find so important and interesting is about us. It's about the human microbiome or about finding out how some disease works or why we're happy, why we're not happy, how our brains work, what determines whether or not we're left-handed, which is a Café Scientifique I'm going to be sad to miss. And what I think is sometimes missing is that there's this whole wonderful world out there that isn't about us. And I'd like people to take away that that world is interesting and important as well.
And can you tell us about anything particularly special that's happening at tonight's cafe?
Well, we are going to eat the science at tonight's cafe. So we have, unbeknownst to the people showing up, we have algae chocolate for them to try at halftime break. And we also have some lovely music that was made by a young man named Cameron McNair out of my photosynthesis data. So we have what does photosynthesis and respiration sound like if you turn it into music instead of into a scientific paper. So sort of an alternate analysis of our data will be presented tonight, which will be really fun.
The Society hosts a series of scientific discussion meetings throughout the year, led by scientific experts. The events allow researchers of all career stages to come together and discuss new research in their area. In February, we hosted a meeting entitled The Paradigm Shift for UK Forensic Science, which provided a great forum for discussions ranging from legal issues through to fundamental forensic science.
We caught up with one of the meeting's organisers, Professor Sue Black, to find out how the two-day meeting had gone. And we also spoke with one of the event speakers, Professor Paul Thomas, about the legal perspective on forensic science in the UK.
My name is Sue Black. I'm the Director of the Centre for Anatomy and Human Identification at the University of Dundee. And alongside Professor Niamh McDade, my colleague also from Dundee, we were incredibly fortunate to receive funding from the Royal Society to put on a discussion meeting that would look at the relationship between forensic science and the law.
And how have you found the last couple of days? Has it drawn out new things for you? Have you had sort of new audiences?
It's been a tremendous experience for us. I don't think there's a better word for it. We've done a lot of work beforehand because it might surprise a lot of people to know that there has been very little dialogue between science and the law. So to come to somewhere like the Royal Society, which is our national academy, it is absolutely the right place to do this. So we knew that we were on a very good and solid territory in which to have these discussions. And what has been really interesting is how when we've brought our international colleagues over, then there has been no hesitation. Absolutely everybody that we have asked has come. And that shows a number of things. It shows the draw of the Royal Society and the importance that they will play in how we move forward with this. But it also shows that there's a willingness and a tremendous amount of good international will to address what the problems are in forensic science. I think getting it out into a wider public audience was extremely important. There were some difficult questions, but that's good, because those are things that we shouldn't shy away from. And I think it's been a very open meeting, a very good meeting, and I think new friends made, but also a tremendous step forward into a little bit of an abyss. We're not quite sure where the paradigm's going to take us, but I think the steps that we've made are really firm ones.
I'm Paul Roberts. I'm Professor of Criminal Jurisprudence at the University of Nottingham, and I've had an interest in the relationship between law, science, expertise, and issues around that ever since. And we've been hearing over the last few days about different aspects of forensic science practice, from crime scene investigation to technological development in autopsies. My own paper, Scientific Evidence, Criminal Justice and Dr. Faustus. Many of the points I was making, and things I've said on other occasions about the difficulties of lawyers, forensic scientists and other experts communicating with one another in an effective way, whether that be in the courtroom, and of course that catches a lot of the public imagination, but in many ways more importantly in the investigative and pre-trial processes, where the environment is more conducive to productive engagement between police, forensic scientists, prosecutors and defence lawyers. We're all in the business of trying to ensure that the quality of forensic science information that goes into the criminal process is of the highest quality it can be, that it doesn't, you know, risk or lead to miscarriages of justice.
And do you think that talking across different disciplinary boundaries has brings new solutions or new approaches to some of these problems? Have you learned about the way that this is viewed from other parts of the system?
Well, I think you always learn when you go to an event like this, because if I use the jargon, the stakeholders are so diverse. There isn't just one thing called forensic science. Mm. There are 10, 30, 50 different specialisms and subspecialisms in the forensic science field. We've heard for the last 2 days about things that were new fields, DNA profiling, a prominent example of that, are now subdividing into subspecialisms. So you don't get one DNA expert, there are three different ones. So there's always a challenge of speaking across disciplinary boundaries, coming up with terminology that's understandable and fit for purpose across different disciplines. And when you add the legal and the justice elements into all of that on top, then these are non-trivial practical problems that need to be addressed. So I think that it's reassuring that so many high profile prominent people, including the Lord Chief Justice of England and Wales, have come to this event, supported it and spoken it, and that shows a real willingness at the highest levels to engage with these questions, and they are that important.
You can find out more about this meeting on our website. Also, look for a future issue of our journal Philosophical Transactions B, which will be publishing papers from the meeting. If you are interested in organising a scientific meeting with the Royal Society in the future, you can also find out more details on our website.
Every year, the Royal Society Michael Faraday Prize is awarded to a scientist or engineer in recognition of their expertise in communicating scientific ideas in lay terms. Past winners, who have included Jocelyn Bell Burnell, Richard Forte and David Attenborough, are called upon to give the annual Faraday Prize lecture at the Royal Society. Professor Andrea Seller was the 2014 prize winner, and in the minutes before Andrea gave his lecture, we got to speak with him about communicating science and why it's good to be nervous.
Firstly, I'd like to start by saying congratulations.
Thank you very much. Imposter syndrome spares no one, and so I'm as surprised, I think, as the next man to be the
really?
Recipient of this prize. Yes.
Well, how did it feel when you were first told about the prize?
Oh, I mean, I was completely delighted, there's no question, when I got the letter announcing that I'd won. But I was also, you know, incredibly astonished.
Right? I mean, you must be worthy of the job, though.
Well, I mean, yeah, I'm aware that I've done a lot, and I've certainly tried very hard to speak for chemistry, and to speak for chemistry in a way, as much as I can, away from chemistry itself. In other words, to try and show chemistry in a broader and deeper context.
What is it that's made you actually put so much of your time into science communication as well as academic research?
I mean, there's no question. I mean, this is a complete time vampire. It just sort of sucks time out of everything. But I think there are two things. I mean, the first thing is that I think it's important and valuable. There's a huge sense of chemophobia around, but there's also a bit of a science-ophobia at the moment, and I think it's extremely important for us to stand up and actually explain what it is that we do, and also to get people to recognize the extraordinary intellectual achievements that science presents. And I think sometimes as chemists, we kind of undersell that, particularly by focusing on blowing stuff up. That's kind of, you know, everyone tonight, of course, is here because they're hoping that I will burn the Royal Society down at last. But I think, you know, the other reason is because, you know, I guess I am good at it, and my colleagues, I was very fortunate that they kind of accepted that, you know, I could do this and that it had benefits. And really, you know, the difficulty for me is how to balance trying to be research active in teaching, you know, active in, you know, one of the things that I think is incredibly important for the universities is to address green or, if you will, sustainability issues. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, to be out there kind of speaking up for chemistry. And it's a tough juggling act, especially if you want to continue to have a family.
Is that what you mostly do? Is it public lectures?
I mean, I do quite a lot of public lectures, but I also do a lot of radio, a lot of television. I've presented several radio documentaries. I appear, you know, I have a series that I'm involved in on BBC World Service called Elemental Economics, which is for me a total dream gig because I'm absolutely sick of talking about the elements from the perspective of them being, you know, stuff. You know, it's not simply stuff that is being discovered within the science pigeonhole, but actually it's the foundation of our world. And what I really want to talk about is the way in which you can use this stuff.
Have you ever spoken to Martin Polyakov about this?
Yeah. I mean, you know, Martin Polyakov is fantastic, and his periodic videos have really struck an incredible chord. And, you know, I was very fortunate that he invited me to take part in one of these where I did something completely idiotic, which was I cast a mercury bell that lived in our minus 80 freezer. And so I attempted to ring it for him. And the great thing about mercury is that solid mercury is not very stiff, and so it doesn't ring. So it's a kind of a joke. But Martin has been, I think, tremendous in galvanizing attention for the elements and for chemistry. And I think they're great because they're very direct. They haven't got high production values. They're kind of fun, spontaneous, off the cuff, and full of laughs.
On that topic, what would you see the future of science communication as? So maybe in like 50 years' time?
Well, I mean, it's certainly a sign of the times. There's absolutely no question that if you're going to have a profile, then you have to have some kind of profile online, some activity online. But certainly, you know, Twitter and Facebook and so on are here to stay. And where they will be in 50 years' time, I don't know. But there's no question that it's becoming ever easier to, you know, put things out there and to ask questions and particularly to respond to audiences and in a fun sort of way.
It's quite a prestige prize to be winning. Do you feel nervous for the lecture?
Oh, excited? I mean, I think my internal sort of state is one of absolutely stark, raving terror. I mean, I've been extremely nervous for weeks now. And, I mean, you know, the thing is that nerves are very important. And, you know, in this case, I'm close to being paralytically nervous. I'm kind of worried about, you know, all kinds of things, about, you know, how certain things will go and whether the message I'm trying to get across actually works and whether I won't talk too much and overshoot my time. You know, there are all these things. But all of that really is part and parcel of of the deal, and that is the fact that, you know, you care, that it's really important. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this evening is kind of particularly difficult because this being a formal lecture, I feel I've had to write a formal text, and that's not something that I normally do. Normally, I do speak rather off the cuff, and it tends to become a bit of a shaggy dog story. But, you know, I do have a text, and the problem is, how do I use the text and at the same time be able to switch to A, slides, and B, a few videos, and then on top of that do demos without actually losing my place in the text? And I think that's the thing which is really causing me the most worry.
Is this your script here?
But yes, this is my script, and I'm keeping it very close just because I was hoping to have a few minutes in which I could desperately cut stuff out of it.
Oh, no.
We've got the script here. It's carefully color-coded to try and remind me not to forget, right, what I have to do at various points. And I just hope I'm able to negotiate my way through
this. Is that an hour and a half?
Well, this should, I hope, be somewhere around 50-something minutes.
Oh, is that right?
But that doesn't actually take account of the fiddling, right?
Yeah.
And the fiddling is the real problem, I think, is that ends up invariably sort of taking a little bit more time. I mean, one of the things is that over the years I've just become so used to talking and doing a demonstration to illustrate things. That now I find it actually almost difficult to talk without fiddling. But the thing that I find is that having a demonstration, having an object, doing something a bit like show and tell, actually makes an enormous difference, because what it does is it breaks you away from that rigid sense of having either a script in front of you or alternatively, you know, something on the screen that the audience is kind of reading desperately. And on the other hand, if you've got something to hold, something to fiddle with, right, then people focus more. And it just lends a little bit more energy and color to what you're recording. Seeing stuff on video is one thing, but seeing it live is something else. And there's a tension that comes with doing it live. But I think even more important than that is for people to actually try stuff out for themselves and to go and sort of play and experiment in the kitchen, and I hope that's something I'm going to talk about tonight.
The Faraday Prize lecture that followed was a spectacular display of chemistry, and if you missed it, you can see the full video recording on the Royal Society website. Next month, we will also be celebrating 350 years of our journal, Philosophical Transactions, the oldest scientific journal in the world. In the last episode, you heard from some of the committee behind the films that tell some of the stories they wanted to tell about the history of the journal. And in this episode, you're going to hear some of the audio from the films themselves.
Submit a paper, have it properly reviewed, and then there was a record of what you had done. Really clarified how science works. And I would say this is one of the most significant steps in the history of all of science. I think sort of one of the most important things the Royal Society ever did, and it did it right at its beginning in 1665, was to invent essentially the scientific journal, with this journal, Philosophical Transactions, publishing articles describing the work. But having the journal...
relax.
They could get it out there, they'd published it, they were owners of it, and there was a date on it, so it was they got priority.
It's still very important now to have this.
Exactly. Isn't that interesting? That was invented in 1665, and that's basically the same thing as we have now. All the thousands, tens of thousands of scientific journals, they publish regularly, they're dated, they're peer-reviewed. It's all exactly the same model.
The election of the first women to the Royal Society must have been very significant, because it must have been seen as something of a stumbling block. And it meant it was possible other women could aspire to this, because up till that point, they must have wondered if ever the Society would let women in.
This is an early paper by Kathleen Lonsdale, quite a long time before she was actually elected.
Oh, yes. 1929.
A paper on benzene. Getting, I think, some derivative of benzene to crystallise so she could work out its structure. So this was a long time before her election. Her election was 1945, along with Marjorie Stevenson, so the pair of them got elected together. It must have been quite
amazing.
Amazing, but possibly also intimidating. I don't know.
I expect she might have been used to that.
She probably was used to it. I expect she was always in a minority of
exactly
about one.
Darwin, who later became a great scientific icon, could make serious errors, as he did in Glenroy. But equally, it's important to recognise that you've got to discriminate between the facts on the one hand, the evidence, that is, and the interpretation on the other. This is the Philosophical Transactions from 1839, with Darwin's paper in it. If you look at Darwin's map, then the location and elevation of the roads is pretty much exactly the same as you would find in a modern map using satellite imagery. So Darwin's facts have remained steady and constant and usable. But of course his theories now, we were completely wrong. And Darwin himself, of course, recognised this. And in, I've got a copy here of his book on the Descent of Man. And he writes something which is very relevant to what's happened to his observations in the parallel roads. False facts, he writes, are highly injurious to the progress of science, for they often endure long. But false views do little harm, for everyone takes a great pleasure in proving their falseness.
The fireworks paper wasn't the first infiltrans to rely on crowdsourced observation. In 1715, Edmund Halley, whose tombstone this is, asked everyone to help him record a total solar eclipse. It's a good job he didn't just rely on his friends and colleagues. He got observations from here at the Royal Observatory Greenwich, but it was cloudy in Oxford, and in Cambridge, the professor that was supposed to make the observations was troubled by untimely visitors, made them tea instead of watching the eclipse. Luckily, amateur observers from all across the country came to the rescue, and their measurements helped Halley record the distance to the moon and to the sun.
This piece of kit here actually is typical of the sort of instrumentation that you launched on Skylark. Very, very small and with quite a primitive purpose. Tell me about this.
Well, its purpose was to register X-ray emission from the sun, but it's extremely simple. And behind that, photographic film, which of course is blackened by the incoming solar X-rays. Measure the photograph later, and you understand the X-ray intensity, but very crude because, of course, it was simply mounted on a rocket which was spinning but not accurately pointed. So you just hoped that on one or more of the rotations this actually went past the sun and got some X-rays.
That's almost it from us, so thanks for listening. But we always end by asking, why science?
Why science? Because science is really fun. It's how the world works, and I think there are lots of ways you can do that. You can do that with art, you can do that with music, you can do that with interpretive dance, you can do it with structural engineering, you know, whatever you want. But the thing I like about science is that it's a way of exploring the world that's really outside me. It's really outside humans. And I find that, frankly, really interesting. I think it's fun to learn about and understand the world I live in a way that isn't entirely human-centric. Which almost all other ways of exploring the world are. And on a practical level, it's sort of like I wake up in the morning, my job is essentially to play in a sandbox, to answer questions I find super interesting, and talk to people who are really smart and similarly interested in these questions. So it's an incredibly fulfilling career, I would say, an incredibly fulfilling way to spend your one and only life. There's, like any job, it's not perfect, but given that I have to exist in this reality, I can't think of a more perfect job here and now.